across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello and welcome to Community Focus, the programme that highlights the work of charities and community groups across the city and South Cambridgeshire. I'm Neil Whiteside, and on today's programme I'll be speaking to Chris Jenkin, one of the organisers of the Cambridge Summit for Homelessness, which took place at the end of November. We'll be finding out what progress has been made since the summit and what the plans are for the future. But first to this month's Charity of the Month. All of us here at Cambridge 105 were deeply saddened by the untimely death of our Mayor, Councillor Nigel Gawthrop. We wanted to show our respect in some way, and so we decided to adopt his chosen charity, the Red Hen Project, as our charity for February. Last Friday, Lee Chambers' guests were the chair of the Red Hen Project, Leslie Ford, and Chris O'Reilly, who's a senior family worker. They told Lee how it all began.
We started back in 1998. Three primary schools north of Cambridge, and the head teachers between them recognised that there are quite often social barriers to learning. So they started by employing a homeschool worker, which was Chris, and she's still with us. Families having difficulties getting their children to school on time or without breakfast, or family issues interfering with their learning. We've expanded since then. We're a five school charity now, still in the same part of town. And Chris, do you want to talk about the kind of issues that we deal with?
Yeah, the barriers to learning. Because you mentioned very practical things there, but do you just have practical things or psychological elements as well?
Well, all of it, really. I mean, there are some children who struggle with their learning because there are no routines at home, so they're not going to bed, so they're not getting up in the morning. Their life is chaotic. There are other children who, if they're coming to school, in their head is full of the fact that their mum may have mental health problems, they may have witnessed domestic violence at home, they may be worried because there's no money in the house, there's no food, they're worried about whether they'll have their home, will be there when they go home. All those adult things that children shouldn't be looking at or worrying about. And when you're a child and your head's full of that, it's really hard to go into school, enjoy your day, and learn anything. Focus on what you're supposed to be learning.
So how do you help them in those situations?
Well, we go into the family home, we meet the parents first, talk about what the issues are. We help them to address the things for the adults, because they can't prioritise their children if they've got these big adults, big problems. So we'll help them. If there are domestic violence issues, we help them to access the right support. If there's poverty, we help them to sort out any benefits they're entitled to, help them to sort out debts, help them immediately to access some food and some electricity and gas if that's an issue. We then help them to put in routines, so their children will have a proper bedtime and they will have proper meal times. Things will be more relaxed and calmer at home, and we will let the children know that actually it's not their responsibility to address any of these issues. Their parents are doing it with our help, and they can actually get on with the job of being a child.
My goodness, these are big things to address, though, because presumably some families have not one issue, but several.
Most families will have several of those issues going on all at one time. And we have an issue these days where families don't live near their extended family quite often, so mum isn't round the corner.
We've kind of got a mission statement which we've borrowed either from an African proverb or something, which is that it takes a village to raise a child. And I think increasingly in these times, that village doesn't really exist, because people live in a distance from their big sister or their mother or their grandmother. So there is nobody that's close enough to say to people who are having difficulties, come on, pull your socks up, get the kids to bed. And so, unlike social care, which, you know, intervenes in family situations, as we all know, who are also under increasing financial pressures, of course, we can be there at grassroots, one-to-one intervention early on, giving the practical help. And our workers do, I'm proud to say, come across like extended family members in their practicality and their firmness in how they pick these issues up. And the other thing that we do is outreach activities. So we try and build a community by having coffee mornings, where you will often hear one parent say to another, well, this is what I do when they won't go to bed, why don't you try that? So that's what we're doing as well, building a community, a support network.
So what makes you different from social services? I know that some families may be reluctant to contact social services for various reasons. What makes your organisation different?
We're very small, we're very local. We work closely with schools, And parents have to have a relationship with their child's school, whether they like it or not. We also try and improve the relationships with families and schools. And I think we're seen, we have a really good reputation locally, actually, and I think we're seen as non-threatening. And we are not just a gateway to more heavy-duty services, if you like. We are communication between them. If that's needed, we'll bring that in. You know, we're not there to fix everything, but we are, I think we're seen as non-threatening.
So how do people come onto your register? Are they flagged up by the school? Do they contact you directly?
Yeah, referrals from schools, Chris, right?
Yeah, generally we get referrals from school, but because we're really well known in the community, we do get self-referrals, or we will have families we're working with who will flag up a friend who's saying, she's really struggling, do you think you can help them? So we get to know families that way. And also when we have our drop-in groups, coffee mornings and things, families can come in there and they can ask for advice. And I think because you don't have to be referred, and you can seek that help yourself, you may well seek it earlier rather than wait till you get to really chronic crisis levels.
What a nice job you have. I mean, you must see literally families turning their lives around.
We absolutely do. I'm sure Chris could share many stories about that kind of thing. And we recently had one of our families, the mum became a trustee, which was amazing. That thing. She's had to stop now because she's got a full-time job now, which is also remarkable. So yeah, there are, for every case we have, there's a wonderful story of something changing fundamentally for a family.
And Chris, I was saying, you've been with the organisation since the beginning. Is there one story that sticks in your head?
Oh, there are so many. I think what's amazing is we run, just to be out in the community and raise some money for our emergency fund, we run a stall at the local Arbury Carnival. And families that we've been working with many, many years ago will come and seek us out every year to show us their children. They now have children, and they tell us how well they've done, and they remind us of the things that they remember. So we have lots and lots of families who do turn it around. I can't think of one off.
I put you on the spot, don't worry. But yeah, I mean, you've been with the charity since its beginning, Chris. What about you, Leslie? What's your background?
Well, I was a full-time teacher at one of the schools when this charity started. So the head teacher that I was working with then was one of the three heads that started the charity. And I've been a trustee for a large amount of that time as well. And I've watched the charity grow in terms of its efficiency and its visibility and its reputation, not growing its size, because we're not really about that. We're about staying small and relevant and local. What I have seen, though, is a difference in the issues that we're dealing with. And there is so much more poverty now. It's not just about families in crisis with an issue that's stopping the kids, you know, being children, as Chris beautifully puts it. There's a lot of poverty issues. So referrals to food banks, our Christmas appeal to get people to donate toys for Christmas presents, using Fair Share food from Tesco's to redistribute food. So lots more poverty issues now.
And what do you do in that situation? How do you help in that situation?
We have a little emergency fund for families in real crisis. We do take, we share out the food that comes. Is it Thursdays, Chris? I think Chris does deliver us bags.
Yeah, Thursday evening, I get a message from Tesco's to say they've got some food that would otherwise go in the bin. I go and collect it. It's absolutely perfectly good food. It's just they're not allowed to sell it. And it may have damaged boxes, or it may be going out of date after today. And I collect it on a Thursday evening. We have a list of families who are really, really struggling to feed their children. So we go around on a Friday morning and we deliver food parcels for them for the weekend. We have people donate food to us. The church and the schools will give us their canned and packets food from harvest festivals. We keep that in the office. So when we get a call from a school or a family, say, my benefits have stopped, I don't know what I'm going to do, or I'm on a 0 hours contract, I've got no work this week, we can go out with a couple of shopping bags with food so they can.
It's a scary statistic that we saw in a little film that was made by a couple of students about Cambridge being the most unequal city in the UK. And about 33% of the children in North Cambridge are living in a definition of poverty.
A third?
Yeah, a third of children.
That's staggering, isn't it?
It's shocking, isn't it, really? Because you think of Cambridge as the university and the leafy villages, and then right in our midst is this area of significant social disadvantage, and it's not getting any easier.
And you're one of the reasons you're our adopted charity, not just because of the brilliant work you do, is also you are the adopted charity of the late mayor of Cambridge, Nigel Gawthorpe.
We are,
so
yeah.
Sad loss for you.
Really. Absolutely. Sad. Yeah.
He was a big part, wasn't he? He came
and
lots
a real champion. We were about to appear together to talk about the charity at the Guildhall. The Pentacle Club of Cambridge and Magicians are doing a show in our aid. So, I won't get to see Nigel be the butt of a trick or two from them, but that's really sad. We hope that Jenny will continue, his wife will continue to be a friend of ours. A sad loss for us.
He was Father Christmas for us at our Christmas party.
Oh, was he?
He was amazing. The children
loved
him. Oh,
I can imagine him being a great Father Christmas.
He was.
If people want to find out more about your work, it's redhenproject.org. If people want to help you, are there roles for people to help, or if people want to support the work in some way?
Always, yeah. We're very keen to build a volunteer base. Any information you need will be on the website. There is also a donate now button. We've been very fortunate to have been funded by the Big Lottery for two rounds of funding, but that will run out in 3 years' time, in which case we will be self-funding. They won't fund us again. We know that. So we're putting a lot of work in now to ensure that we can carry on. So in 20 years' time, because we're 20 years old this year, in 20 years' time, we'll come back and talk again about how we're managing on our own.
I'll probably still be here as well. Brilliant. Well done. Brilliant work that you do. Redhenproject.org, and lovely to have you as our charity of the month.
Thank you.
Lee Chambers speaking with Chris O'Reilly, who's the senior family worker with the Red Hen Project, and the chair of the project, Leslie Ford. And you can find out more about all our charities of the month on the Cambridge 105 Radio website, and you can hear all the interviews under the catch-up section. Now, last November saw the first ever Cambridge Summit for Homelessness. It was organised under the auspices of Dr. Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury and now the Master of Magdalen College here in Cambridge. One of the senior organisers was Chris Jenkin. He's well known both for setting up the Street Pastors Project here in Cambridge and also for the Cambridge Church's Homeless Project, which provides food and shelter for some of our homeless and rough sleepers during the winter months. I caught up with Chris earlier this week and found out more about what's been going on since the summit.
Well, for quite a long time now, we've been thinking in the city about what more can we do to support people that are becoming homeless, to help them off the streets more quickly, etc. And it came to me what's happening in Manchester under the leadership of Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester. And I went up in February to one of his meetings as a bit of an interloper from Cambridge, and big meeting, big summit, the third of their summits actually. And I was very impressed with the way that they were bringing the whole community together in a very non-partisan way about what we can do locally here, not what we can't do locally here.
Right.
So that was the inspiration. And working with my friend and colleague John Canessa and others, we conceived the idea of the Cambridge Summit on Homelessness. We tested the idea with one or two people in leadership positions, and it seemed to be that it was the right time for it. And in fact, we just found over the summer, as we explored it, all the doors were opening for us. St Paul's Church very kindly agreed to host it, and we had the entire premises, and quite a number of people from the church who were really adept at organising things did all the food and the AV and all the things like that. And between us, we developed this big invite list of hundreds of people that we thought we might invite across the community. And we were very pleased indeed that Dr. Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury and the current Master of Magdalen College, very kindly agreed to lend his name to the event. And so the invitations went out in his name, which obviously it meant that a lot of very senior people probably took more notice of the invite than otherwise they would have done. And we invited, I think, about 180 people, and we didn't know who would turn up, if anyone. But the responses kept coming in, and it crept over 100, and so it went on. And on the day, to our complete amazement, 150 people turned up. And I think the no-shows were about 10 people, 12 people couldn't. On the final day, they couldn't arrive for one reason or another, which is a very small proportion.
Yeah.
And the second amazing thing that happened, we'd framed, as you have seen, the 10 conversations, different topics, posing questions, discussion points where hopefully people come together, share their experiences, particularly with those who've lived on the street, and identify perhaps new ways of helping people from the street into permanent accommodation. And that was quite important input. A lot of work was done to create that framework and do the analysis so people could see what was there. We weren't about reinventing the wheel or cutting across existing programs. And there was that point in the summit where everybody had to choose which of those 10 conversations to go to. And now, to our complete astonishment, the room emptied.
Yeah.
And then there were 10 conversations happening around the different rooms in the church, which was very moving, actually, for those of us that have been involved in the lead up to it. And then everybody had their flip charts and they wrote things up. And I think nearly 100 people filled in little one-page feedback forms, giving their name and contact details and saying which conversations they'd like to continue to be part of as we go forward, and as it were, giving us permission to communicate with them. And so after the event, we then collected all that massive data and simply set it out conversation by conversation. So, dear people in conversation two, thank you so much for coming. These are the notes that were taken, a copy back, so you remember what was put up on the little whiteboards. This is what we think was coming out of that. These are the people involved. These are the people who made certain commitments. Go for it. Whatever you need help, let us know. So that was all framed up in December. And then we kind of paused and let's see what happens next. And gradually people in the groups began to convene meetings. We did a little bit of pushing from the sidelines in order to encourage those that said they would. Look, let's actually get a meeting. And of the 10 conversations now, conversations 1 to 7, seven of the topic areas have a leader and someone that's six of them have had at least one meeting so far. And one is about to convene a meeting, the first follow-up meeting. One other conversation we've merged into another one, so they sort of come together. And one conversation didn't really take off at this point. It may take off in the future. And the final thing we're doing is there was a conversation about how we continue the journey together in terms of networking, communication, coordinating, steering group, what I've called the potential for a Cambridge Homeless Partnership, for us as a community to agree some sort of charter for homelessness, as has happened in a number of other cities. And we've just today put out an invite to any who has been participating in the conversations to help us form a steering group that will help to coordinate and facilitate and encourage the various conversations, keep them on a track of certain values and principles that we would like to adopt, to raise funds, to see how to liaise with the other structures around the county and the city that are concerned with support and housing and so on, to see whether we can establish this wider partnership on a more formal basis in due course, to help the conversation progress from not just conversation and not just action, but sustained change for the city. So the end result then is things that will help to eliminate the need for anyone to sleep rough due to homelessness. Central government has sent out a plan to halve rough sleeping across the country by 2022 and eliminate it by 2027. And we should do at least as well as that, if not better.
You plan on being ahead?
Cambridge has more resources than you can shake a stick at in terms of a lot of very intelligent people and a lot of money. It's a very wealthy city. It may be the most unequal city in the UK, but in terms of free cash and in terms of property values, where many people have done very well out of property, there's plenty of resources there. Mm. And we sense through the summit and all the preparation and what's followed that many people that have done well want to know, what can I do? They see the issue on the streets day by day. What can I do to help? And we want to find opportunities for that help to be given in a way that's coherent, that's consistent with the policies and plans that are in place currently, that doesn't cut across things, doesn't upset the current systems overmuch, and gives a way for people to say, actually, I think I can see how I can make a real difference, not just to ameliorate the situation, not just make it more comfortable for people to be on the street, but actually to help people to come off and rebuild their lives in some sort of sustained accommodation.
And it does seem as if you are creating that, you mentioned that umbrella structure, yeah, right? Yeah. Because the thing which struck me when I came to the summit was when we first moved into the room, you know, there you are, you're in St. Paul's Church, and maybe groups of two or three were speaking in hushed tones.
Yes.
And by the end of the morning, you couldn't hear yourself think. Yes. For the conversation, and people were saying, well, if we'd have had another hour, if we'd have had another this, yeah, we're busy talking.
Yes,
and it sent that involvement of academia, that bringing in of the university alongside the homeless themselves and the rough sleepers themselves and the organisations that the various bodies, public and civic, that are dealing with, yeah, it, seems to be the way forward, doesn't it? It's just a case of getting everybody to do some joined up thinking in the same room.
Absolutely. Well, I think, though, as someone said in our planning group, someone came up with this catchphrase of a tagline of it takes a city.
Yeah.
And the recognition, which we've seen elsewhere, and this is really what we learned, you know, from Manchester and other workplaces, that it does take a city to deal with this issue. It's not simply an issue that can be sorted out by the local district council or the county council or the health authority. It needs to be a community-wide issue where we come together. And I think people bought into that. Yeah. They bought into the fact it takes a city, and that we need to bring together local authorities, charitable organisations, the professional community in the homelessness sector that have on the front line for these things, businesses, the academia, etc., who have skills, land, money, experience, time, effort they want to put in, a heart to help and a heart to communicate, a heart to serve. It's tapping into that wellspring, I think, of compassion to people that are, as we sometimes put it in our Christian churches, the last, the least, and the lost on the street. People who have become without hope,
yeah,
and without help. And this is about extending a helping hand, but a hand up, not a hand out. So helping people, or giving more opportunities and more support to access those opportunities into housing, of which obviously that's the big ticket item.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it is. You mentioned Andy Burnham and his steps in Manchester they've taken. Are there things that actually Manchester have kind of got like an economy of scale? Presumably the numbers are bigger,
yeah,
by a factor of whatever in Manchester. Yeah. Does that make it in a way easier to solve a problem because it is bigger than Cambridge? Or what have you had to adapt what you've seen there?
Yes, I mean, they have got obviously a big problem. It's a big city, a big conurbation of towns. And big issues require big solutions. And so having the mayor deal with a situation that really spreads across the cities around central Manchester is clearly very, very important. In Cambridge, really the problem is mostly within Cambridge City, for obvious reasons, in terms of the footfall of concerned people that can help people that are on the street, but sometimes that can help sustain people on the street, and the fact that the homelessness resources and spend is concentrated in the city, and so it's recognised around the other districts that Cambridge has the lion's share of the resources and the funding to support homelessness, and therefore Cambridge City tends to be where the problem is most keenly felt. But obviously, it does involve South Cambridgeshire District Council as well,
yeah,
the ring of villages around, especially in terms of housing opportunities, and obviously extends into the other districts as well. But at the summit, we've focused upon Cambridge City. When we have another one, we may we'll see how people feel, but it may be appropriate to embrace the wider number of districts and the county as a whole.
And that much, as you say, because with things like housing, much cheaper if you can be outside. You can do more with more bang for your buck or whatever.
Yeah,
outside,
subject, of course, to transport and access to jobs. So that is always the dilemma, is that you can find cheaper housing elsewhere, but then you're taking people away from their social networks and employment opportunities and adding a transaction cost to their day.
Sure.
Even if their housing costs are reduced, the transaction cost of getting to and from work is time and money is that much higher.
Okay. And you mentioned these six conversations that are now up and running underway. What's the highlights of that as far as you're concerned? What are you seeing that you didn't expect?
The six conversations it's quite a lot going on. So I just put them in order rather than any kind of priority. So one of them is around looking at joining the Street Support Network, which is a national platform developed in Manchester, what we probably call Street Support Cambridge, and that's an online platform that allows you to find out what's happening, to offer help, receive help, communicate. How can I give? How should I give? Provide ways and means for people to give money and time. Communicate the numbers. What programs are underway? What's working? What's not working? So a pretty comprehensive view can be developed of what is happening in around homelessness. How are people being helped? How can I help? How can my organisation help? Who's doing what? So it applies to the wider public, to concerned individuals, to businesses, to those on the streets directly, to frontline workers, etc. Mm-hmm. There's no current sort of central resource that brings all that together. And also how we work together, you know, how we collaborate. So yes. Things post-summit collaboration need some sort of platform where we can share ideas and thoughts and communicate, etc. So that's one. The second one is on information. And as you all know, recently the Rough Sleeping Statistics were published nationally. And as is quite clearly reported, it's simply a snapshot. It's a one-night view. People are on the streets from 4 o'clock till 6 o'clock one morning in November to identify who's sleeping rough. Those are what are called the official numbers. But, of course, it's only a snapshot of those that happen to be found on one morning in November. Now, if you look at the wider statistics, the number of people that knock on the door of Jimmy's and are unable to get in, the number of people that approach Winter Comfort, use Winter Comfort, their amazing daycare centre, and many people, when they sign in, they declare, are they rough sleeping or not? And many people declare that they're rough sleeping. So if you look at the people that are potentially rough sleeping or vulnerably housed and at risk of rough sleeping, then it's nearly 1,000 people. Last year, we're in what we call housing crisis, put their hand up and say, look, I need help now or very, very soon, and we're not able to be helped now or very, very soon, and therefore sort of went back to whether it's sofa surfing or rough sleeping or whatever it might have been. And so, obviously, if someone is found sleeping rough, sleeping bag, 6 in the morning, tick, that is definitely a rough sleeper. Although there were 27 found in November, 160-odd people were found rough sleeping throughout the year.
Right.
And a further 60 sightings who may have been the same person seen 60 times or yes. 60 different people, we don't quite know, but no. Obviously somewhere in the middle. So, you know, it's around a couple of hundred people were discovered rough sleeping at one point or the other during the year. Obviously, for others, we can't verify, but I'm sure people are not turning up asking for help if they're sleeping comfortably in their three-bed house. So we can assume there is some housing crisis, some need that is unmet for those. So getting those figures correct, feeding that in from all the touch points where people knock on the metaphorical door and ask for help, identifying those people in a consistent way so we know if one person is knocking on lots of different doors asking for help, that we know what the needs are. In London, that's done by a system called the Common Homelessness Information Network, or CHAIN, which is used by all London boroughs and all touch points. And so we're working to see if we can implement that system here, and the council folks are being very kind and working on that.
Well, it's in their interest as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because all your budgeting and all your preparations are based on presumably what could be, what's generally accepted to be, not an erroneous count, but it's undershooting, by a huge factor.
And we're trying to understand really the housing pathways. So what's a typical journey for someone from their first putting their hand up, say, I need help, through to being in sustained accommodation, through whatever system of pathway, whether it's through the hostel system or Housing First or through a related charity, whatever it might be. And of course, that pathway has a cost associated to it, which is a cost to all of us, but also a cost to the person. If that pathway is long and complicated, it just prolongs the time when they're able to be in their own sustained accommodation and rebuild their social and spiritual capital, employment and so forth. So that's an important about information, getting it, reporting it appropriately, not that it becomes a stick with which to beat people that are trying to help, you know, those on the street, but a valuable source of information that we can all share and get around. So we understand now what's going on, and that should inform.
Well, policies. That way, again, you can then benchmark whether various initiatives are becoming a success, because at least you know your sources of information are consistent.
Yes, that's correct. Housing obviously is a big topic.
Yes.
And obviously most of the people involved on the professional side are involved in housing through hostels or supported housing in one way, or the housing associations. And an interesting dynamic is developing over that, where some people are asking, well, we have a homelessness problem, so how many homes do we need? Which is a very good question. And some of our efforts to create new housing opportunities is actually we're taking homes from the general market and adding it into the supported market. Mm. Well, that doesn't increase the supply of housing. It's redressing the imbalances between our homeless friends, who are frequently disadvantaged in access to housing, and the general market. But it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
You take a house out of the general market, which puts the pressure on that market, and you add it into the... and you reduce the pressure on the supported housing market.
But there is a huge amount of empty housing in Cambridge, or reportedly a huge amount of empty housing.
So I understand. And
I think entire blocks of flats that have been built by developers and haven't had a single occupant. And that's got to be a bad thing for anybody, isn't it?
Yes, I don't know too much about that. We don't have visibility of that, unfortunately, but that's clearly an important issue. I know the council has dedicated people working on that, and I know there are many complex reasons why these things happen.
Sure, sure.
But that is, I'm sure, there's a lot of work to be done to create those opportunities. So we're also looking at what, you know, should we therefore create new housing? And so there's one discussion around, you know, is there land available, or are there developments where the new properties can actually be allocated to people who need a respite from the street. So, you know, when you do a big housing development, a certain proportion of social properties housing have to be allocated to affordable housing or social housing. In Cambridge, as I understand it, there's no requirement for that housing to be available at the housing benefit rate.
Right.
And therefore, there's still a gap and a potential discrimination against those that can only afford the housing benefit rate because they're on benefits. And in any event, if someone's been on the street and pitches up to rent a property, you know, oh, good, welcome, sir. And so where are you moving from, sir?
Yes.
Oh, well, what's your current address, sir? Oh, well, you know, and there's an effective discrimination against people, I think. So I think it's important, therefore, we consider how can we use the resources that we can tap into to actually add to the housing supply as well. Are there innovative ways of creating housing? There's a project underway about small community built houses that can go on to spare land for a period of years, maybe until that land is required for something else.
Yes.
So-called modular housing, there's a program underway for that, which is already underway. We're trying to give a little bit of a boost. And others are thinking, well, if I was to provide some serious money, could we actually work with developers to build additional housing that could be used for people that are currently sleeping rough or are perhaps in the hostel system and need to move out? We're looking at different ways of raising funds or communicating.
That comes with its own set of problems, because so often with the more long-term rough sleepers and homeless, getting them to actually live within four square walls, they need help and support and supervision. And there's almost like a staffing cost that goes into managing that as well, isn't it? So it's just such an ongoing practice.
There is indeed. There's obviously a staffing cost in the hostel system
as
well.
Yeah.
Housing First is a term that now is being used quite widely in different places. Lots of work's being done. And there is some work being done in the city already on some Housing First models and how to move that forward. And many of us have, looking at what's been happening elsewhere, would very much want to give a big push, I think, to Housing First.
Right.
And it's particularly, it's not a panacea for everybody, but for those who would be at a disadvantage in standing in front of a normal landlord, it is particularly appropriate for them, and it could potentially be more widely used, in the sense of there's so much, it's so difficult to get into the housing market. You might say, well, actually, we need to find properties that are specifically allocated to people who are never going to make it In other cities, it may be they're not going to make it because they are homeless. They perhaps have some drug or alcohol problems, which make them very unattractive to a normal landlord, and hence Housing First is a solution. You might argue here, actually, the economic disadvantage, the fact that the best that someone can offer is rent at local housing allowance rates, and that's not attractive to many landlords, again, is a reason to provide at least what we call a housing-led model,
right,
where people are helped into housing first with support to sustain that accommodation.
And it's important to emphasise at this point, is we are talking housing, aren't we? We're not talking about shelter-type, refuge-type accommodation. We're talking about permanent or long-term accommodation.
That is,
people,
I mean, I think everybody agree that is the goal
for
most. I mean, there are some who probably, due to specific difficulties, probably need to be in some sort of supported setting for a time with on-site support, etc. There are some that would need that, that would not be able to manage the four walls, as you say.
Yeah.
But most people with the appropriate support, and what Housing First has shown is that there are a number of people who perhaps we consider the most entrenched, the most difficult, could actually handle it very well, provided that the rules which surround them, other than maintain the tenancy and don't trash the place,
yes,
other than that, it's your home.
Yes.
If you need help, we're here.
Yeah.
And it does seem that people in that situation then do respond and say, look, I just want to change what I'm doing here. I want to give up on these. I want to deal with these addictions that I've had and get back onto a better path and find employment and so forth. So, and obviously, it's as we find in our shelter project, once people are in the warm for a time,
that stability
actually,
and comfort,
even if it's on a church floor night by night over the winter, there comes a point where actually this is better than being on the street. Now, let me, let's find a way to move on into accommodation and not back on the street. But there still is a need for, most likely, for some sort of emergency accommodation, what some are now calling a sort of safe space accommodation.
Right.
Where obviously houses don't grow on trees, and therefore it's impractical to suddenly see, a one-bed studio flat appear from nowhere for somebody. But providing some emergency accommodation that's flexible, that doesn't have to be full, can be an important part of the mix. So people who end up on the street come off it very quickly, or maybe never get onto it, they say, well, we know you're going to, lose your house or whatever for whatever reason, but you have a place for you to at least is warm and dry, where you can keep your stuff for a time while we help you, move on to a more appropriate housing pathway. So there will be that need. We provide, as in CCHP, one of the organisations behind the summit, provide that over the winter for a number of people. And we do find that folks, even though it's a very temporary and they can't leave their stuff, they have to move from place to place.
Right.
But the fact of being in a warm, welcoming family environment with fantastic food every night, for a number of weeks, suddenly makes the street look much less attractive.
Yes.
And people then are more incentivized to say, OK, I think I want to move on and not go back to a street lifestyle. Now, we can't accommodate everybody. And some people, obviously, Jimmy's does a fantastic work. The 28-day model of quite quick doesn't suit everybody. We don't give any time constraints for people. They just have to find their own measure. But generally, some people can respond very quickly and some people just take a lot longer to respond. But you need to find some sort of safe space which helps people move on. And particularly for women, who the term safe space has a rather particular meaning.
Yes.
Find it difficult to be accommodated in a service which is predominantly around men. If they've been victims of domestic abuse or sexual violence, then that can be quite difficult. So the next conversation we had, in fact, in the summit was around women and homelessness, which is about looking at the specific needs of women.
And it does seem very underprovided for in the city, apparently.
Yes.
That seemed to be the feeling from the floor.
Indeed so. And there's a piece actually on the Whitworth Trust website currently, which suggests that the house that they support, they don't run it, but they provide support to the residents, is going to be closed this summer.
Right.
Which was part of quite a shock to us, because we thought maybe with the impetus from the summit, we could see to fulfil a dream that many of the women that have been working with us saw of having another supported family-type setting for vulnerable women, and now we find that a particular provision may be disappearing. So there's some effort underway to understand and unpack that and see what can be done. But certainly that there is, we believe, a particular requirement to support women for their particular reasons. And the next conversation was about youth, and the same thing applies there. Young people, which we're thinking 16, 25, so outside, just beyond the care system, but before you get to the full adult services. Again, there are particular needs about safety and security and things like night stop, you know, immediate find a family that someone can go to the first night that they're homeless, just as an immediate respite. And then a staircase of support through to the appropriate accommodation thereafter. And obviously the support requirements around that is different from the, you know, the mainstream adult services. And then employment is also a big issue.
If you won't pardon the pun. Yeah.
There's been some really great work done by Winter Comfort and Cam's Cuisine, the local restaurant chain, finding opportunities for people to explore the world of work and get used to it and then actually find permanent employment. And one or two of the colleges have also been very helpful in terms of supporting our homeless friends, and some may know they're doing it and some may not know they're doing it. Mm. It was very exciting last night at the night shelter. We were at St. Paul's last night, and one person that we're accommodating came in very excited, showing us their offer, their job offer. They're starting permanent work today.
Excellent.
And that probably wouldn't have been possible had we not been able to offer them, you know, night by night accommodation.
Sure.
Whether their employer knows that, we don't know, but they were very excited about that. And we want to increase the opportunity. Sometimes maybe the employer needs to know that there's a vulnerable person coming in. Mm. And so the team they're working amongst, there's, you know, is there a buddy system? Is it going to cost some money? So we're trying to work out, well, two groups are trying to work out, A, what's it take to be ready to be employed?
Yeah.
And what does it take to be ready to be an employer? And then try and encourage people to join some sort of scheme where people know that the employer is getting some support in how best to help this person establish themselves in that workplace.
Well, Cam's Cuisine, interesting, we were on my radio show last week, and it was a point they made, was that when you're doing a scheme like this, it's great, they had a success, but then the second one they had didn't work out. And they said it's important not to turn around at that point and go, let's not. It's okay, so now find us somebody else. And that, I thought, that resilience and that willingness to just put that behind you, move on, I thought that was admirable.
They're great. And in fact, they're taking a lead on this particular set of conversations around employment and trying to find a scheme that other employers can join in with. And also the learning they've had from a number of as you say, some successes and some not so great. What do we learn from that, and how can we mitigate that in future and do things differently that has a more chance of someone getting back into the stream? If you go too quickly, you know, we can all find that. If you try and change too quickly, we fall flat on our faces.
And there is always that there's that feeling that you should, isn't it? Let's get this person off, as you say, let's get this person into a house and into a... Slowly, isn't it?
And we've learned that from other projects we've done where you can actually move people along too quickly without taking the time for the change to be assimilated. And then, of course, support. I mean, we're talking about people, and we're all part of a support network, whether voluntary or professional. What I call walking alongside people on their journey, not confronting, not pulling, not pushing, but walking alongside. And obviously there are many people involved in that, the various housing providers, the hostel providers, groups that are funded by the local authority in all sorts of different ways, on the street, off the street, Winter Comfort and so on. Many people involved in working with people that are sleeping or have been had a recent experience of it and not quite permanently housed as yet, providing support, practical, financial, social, employment, healthcare, physical, mental health, et cetera, all the range of it. And the particular tagline that we came up with is that support needs to be for the journey. what can happen in a typical city is that someone supports you when you're on the street.
Yeah.
You go to a hostel and someone else supports you. You move into another hostel, someone else supports you. You move into some sort of a move-on accommodation and someone else supports you. You move into your own place and then maybe no one supports you, or someone supports you from some different organisation altogether.
Yeah.
You end up telling your story a number of different times.
Yes.
And from all the times I've sat down with friends in our night shelter and other work, and you get to hear the story, it's not always a comfortable story to listen to or even to speak.
Yeah.
With bereavement and trauma and difficult upbringings as part of that. And to have to repeat that time and again can be difficult to do. Some of what we've done within our work has been people come into our shelter project over the winter from off the street, and we get to know them and we stay with them. We try and stay with them through their housing journey, complementing whatever housing situation they move through. It's, it's not perfect by any means, but once you've, as it were, befriended someone, you want to stay with
them.
It's
that consistency again, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And so support for the journey through the system is something that we've been advocating for, and it's being explored at different levels, where actually the support belongs to the person and not to the house. Big change potentially, and quite dramatic potentially. Not easy to implement, but that's what we're kind of arguing for.
But you need to be ambitious with some of these things, don't you?
Yes, and obviously it's not something which the community can do. This is the domain of the professionals, really, mostly. But what we can do is try and organise better volunteer support. And we know that we have, I think, about 300 volunteers in our night shelter project who support night by night. And many of them would just love to get alongside someone the day after. And we have quite strict rules about engagement and so forth. So we're looking at setting up a mentoring and befriending scheme. And one of the housing associations has very kindly taken up that particular baton and is trying to raise funds to have someone develop that. And that would mean that anyone of us could, apply to be a volunteer mentor and befriender, have a bit of training, a bit of vetting, matched with a person I would like to have someone to be alongside me and help, and then perhaps meet once a week for a cup of coffee, just no agenda.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Yeah.
Anything I can, simple. I mean, one thing I found often with doing that with different people is that a friend will turn up with several brown envelopes. Well, Chris, I didn't want to open them, so let's just open them. Sure. Yeah, can we?
Yeah.
And then brown envelopes contain letters full of numbers and dates and paragraphs and bold letters and red letters and whatnot. And it takes a bit of effort to figure out what it means.
Mm.
Very, very simple. And, you've got to ring this number by 4 o'clock today. And that can save sanctions with DWP or maybe a potential eviction because something hasn't happened. So you can prevent problems that way. Or simply have someone to share and be normal with, without a professional coming along with a clipboard and
exactly and reporting back and all that, making your statistic.
And we know from other organisations have told us that where they have a mix of professional and volunteer support, sometimes people respond better with volunteers because they know they don't have to do it. It comes from the heart, not from the wallet, as it were.
Yeah.
Not that we have wonderful professional people, but there's a bit of a, it feels more transactional sometimes.
Indeed.
And so we believe that's one way which the community can complement whatever support system is there and get alongside people. And help, and that helps to build social and spiritual capital as well in terms of just normal human engagement. So,
yeah.
So that's another very exciting development, which we hope will come through. And there were other conversations around giving and begging, which are not quite taking off. But our conversation about the communication platform will include ways to give, when to give, how to give, etc. So information about the question people often ask, should I give money?
It's exactly that.
So some kind of answer to help people make the right choices can be communicated. And providing what we call alternative giving means, like Cambridge Street Aid, which is to say, actually, there's another way to support by giving to this particular charitable fund that can be used to provide effective support for people that are on the street that want to move off it. So, and there are probably other schemes as well that might be developed or exist that we could help communicate. So that conversation is going to meld with conversation one, I think. And then the final thing is how we journey together, you know, all this good stuff. How does it get coordinated and supported and facilitated? And so we just, in fact, put out a call today to everybody that was involved in the summit, inviting people to help us form a little steering group that might become something maybe high level, what I might call the Cambridge Homeless Partnership, which is really a high level, strategic, senior leader with lived experience kind of co-group, mm-hmm. And a steering group that's more concerned with, you know, communication and fundraising and so forth, and coordination of the different actions and keeping an eye on the values and the principles to make sure that we have conversations that get to actions that get to change, making sure we liaise effectively with all the other structures around that are doing things around housing and support, that we're not a thorn in the side, but we're collaborating and cooperating and finding a way to meld the resources together to make a significant difference. So that's the final bit of the jigsaw.
That
puzzle.
Kind of sets it for the future, doesn't it? As soon as you create it in a formal, as soon as you formalise it in that way, it kind of makes it right. This is definitely an ongoing project. This wasn't just a one-off idea to have a chat. This is the way we're going to move forward.
That's what it seems to be. And obviously, we didn't know whether anyone would come or whether obviously at the day, as you said, the buzz was just amazing, which we had no idea what to expect. The follow-up has also been amazing. The enthusiasm to get together and help to move things forward and to provide funds, etc., for different things has been quite significant. So, we now better, you know, find some way to help shape all this together.
Yeah.
Not as much of a we that's trying to lead it, but it's a community. Let's get together and find a way to shape this and do this, you know, as a joint effort. And I think the level of response we had from the summit gives now a bigger urgency to getting that together, in order that we can journey together in an effective and coordinated way.
Now, there was plenty of coverage about it leading up to the event and on the day itself and in the immediate aftermath. But for people who have missed the boat, are there still things that you're looking for? Are there things you need? Or if someone's sitting hearing this and thinking, well, hang on a minute, I wasn't aware I could get. There's things I could do. Are you still open to more people coming in? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, there are. I mean, as I said, we had this big list of hundreds and hundreds of people that we could have invited from all the different statutory organisations at all levels, from the, you know, the chair downwards, etc. And obviously, we couldn't quite, you know, we couldn't go that
sure.
far. But yes, I mean, we are. Various people are getting in contact and say, "Can I talk to you about this in different ways?" And our website. www.ittakesacity.org.uk. Very minimal currently, but it's up and running. There are ways to communicate on there so people can get in contact with us. And a very brief one-liner for each conversation is set out there. And anyone that is keen to be involved is most welcome to have a look at that and get in contact. I mean, we have no particular brief for anyone on this other than a brief to help our friends who are living rough.
Well, it's freezing cold out there still at the moment. Yeah. You're right in the middle of your Cambridge Church's homeless project winter season for 2018-19. So it's at the forefront of everyone's minds at the moment. Let's hope that when we have this conversation this time next year, there's been some huge changes. But for the moment, Chris Jenkins.
We hope so.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Chris Jenkin of the Cambridge Summit for Homelessness and also the Cambridge Church's Homeless Project. And if you want to find out more about the Cambridge Summit for Homelessness and how it's progressing, then that website again is ittakesacity.org.uk. ittakesacity, all one word, .org.uk. And that brings us to the end of Community Focus for this month. As always, you can find out more on our website. You can hear repeats of interviews that have taken place throughout the month. Just go to cambridge105.co.uk and head to the catch-up section. My thanks to all our contributors. We'll be back same time next month. Until then, from me, Neil Whiteside, goodbye. Where
to light the